I've put up a list of about 20 questions on the module webpage for the first assessed essays. Have a look at those and write on any one of them. If there's a question that you'd like to suggest, just come and see me, or else just email me with the proposed question. If you want to meld the question with one of the ones on the list, also feel free to do that. Just make sure that you check that with me. There are at least, I think, two questions on more or less each author that we've looked at. I guess the way we do it would be choose an author that you liked, I think, rather than that you didn't like to write on, and have a look at the two questions for that author. There are a couple of comparative questions, one that says something like, write on any one or all of Marx, Klein, Lukács, etc., those sorts of questions. In the exam, you'll have one question on a specific author, one on a comparative thing dealing with two or three or even more authors read in the module. So think along those two lines, a specific or a more general question. So Lukács' relation to Marx very clearly stated. He's writing in the 19-teens. He's writing in German. He's a Hungarian Jew. Writing in the crest of a revolutionary wave in Hungary. He's part of the Bolshevik Party, which takes power in Hungary in 1918, and then is overturned some years later. But he is convinced that there's this a groundswell of revolutionary energy. I mean, so much of the work that we're reading this term seems to be located at those kinds of moments. Next week we'll read the Communist Manifesto, which is 1848, obviously another sort of year of revolutions, material written in 1917 or around then, very obviously the period of 1968, etc. These uplifts, which are transnational, are often occasion a tremendous theoretical energy as well. But Lukács is basing himself, as he says, on Marx's economic analysis, and then proceeding outwards. So what we're talking about here is an extension of Marx's analysis, not a further reflection, as it were, on what Marx had done, but an argument in some ways that the problem of fetishism or the phenomenon of fetishism has spread, and think of it spreading both as a kind of a geographical, a spatial one, the movement of capitalism across the globe, the movement of consumer society in one sense. But then Lukács is also interested in what we might call the kind of intensive development, the sense in which all aspects of social life begin to be marked by this commodity logic. That's what really interests him. Let's try to think about some of the problems that grow out of the fetish character of commodities. And I've got a couple of points here. First one, to reiterate something that we said last week. We looked at this passage from Jameson, and I would call this reification, as Lukács calls it. Remember that the term is coming from the Latin res, res a thing. So we're talking about a process of thingification here, where we're talking about the movement from quality to quantity, in some sense, the quantification of qualitative aspects. That's what Lukács understands. And reification or thingification involves a forgetting, he says. We see in Jameson's formulation that forgetting is of the traces of production. We can no longer have any kind of direct, immediate, and even the mediated relations between ourselves as consumers and the producers of the products that we use has become so diffuse that it's almost impossible to capture that. So the effacement of the traces of production from the object itself. Writing in the 1930s, Adorno writing to his friend Benjamin. We'll be reading both of these theorists. Here's Adorno saying, objects become purely thing-like the moment they are retained for us without the continued presence of their other aspects, when something of them has been forgotten. And he's obviously referring here to the, in some sense, the traces of living labor in products. There are places in Adorno's work where he says that we're forgetting how to give gifts. For instance, we're forgetting how to give gifts because nowadays what you do in giving gifts very often is you simply buy something. So that in some ways all of those processes, all of the intersubjective dimensions, of course you can be very thoughtful about what you buy, etc. But increasingly that's not what we do. Adorno says we simply buy. Think of the business person who delegates his secretary to get a present for his wife, for instance. That would be a very Adornian kind of model, where that sense of forgetting, something of them has been forgotten, specifically their love would have been forgotten, thought, consideration, those sorts of aspects. Let's look at one other factor to do with capitalist society. This would be a second thing, which I'd call the commodification of everything. For Marx, in talking about the fetishes, Marx is talking very specifically about the market, about the production of goods for exchange, production of goods for sale, etc. Lukács is more interested in this process of the commodification of everything. So not so much in the marketplace, not so much in the shopping centres, but in some ways intersubjective relations, interpersonal relations too. So you can buy almost anything, sperm and eggs advertised on the web, speed dating services provide you with several minute long dates in one night for the right price, human organs and so on. Fewer and fewer realms of life in which the language of money does not speak powerfully. The person who writes this is a tremendous sociologist, died a couple of years ago, Polish, named Zygmunt Bauman, B-A-U-M-A-N, if you're interested. And he wrote increasingly late in his life, I mean, he lived a very long time, but began to write about this idea of what he called liquid modernity. In some senses, the way in which he's talking about the speed and also the sort of the changeability, the exchangeability. The technical term, I think, is fungibility of all objects. This is something that Bauman was particularly interested in. The point is that in capitalist societies, the social logic of exchange doesn't stay within the bounds of the market. It tends to promote an ethos in which not only are all things, but all social life comes to be seen as exchangeable or marketable, and therefore as objectifiable or objectified, as quantitative rather than qualitative. We don't live in a market economy, you could say. We live in a market society. And that difference, that in some ways the logic of the market has come to permeate all aspects of our lives. This takes you quite a long way already towards Lukács. So here is Lukács saying that the transformation of the commodity relation into a thing of ghostly objectivity, we looked at that notion of phantom objectivity last week, doesn't or can't content itself with the reduction of all objects. It stamps its imprint upon the whole consciousness of man. His qualities and abilities are no longer an organic part of his personality. They're things which he can own or dispose of. And we talked about this a little bit in seminars last week about, you know, preparing yourself to put yourself on the market. In that sense, your labor power in some ways, which of course in the capitalist economy is always an object which can be bought and sold. You exchange your labor power for a wage. But if that moves to include all sorts of other features as well, this is what Lukács is referring to. So we see this being registered very decisively, obviously, in modern advertising. I think Benjamin is the first theorist who is attentive to how important advertising is at signaling these changes. Advertising seizes on these things, and Benjamin says, actually, that we learn so much if you look at advertising. at what advertising teaches you about trends in contemporary society. So advertising, of course, treats the whole world as a giant, dazzling conglomeration of things, all of which exist as quantities and so are exchangeable. They can be expressed as values in relation to other things, not only cars and cosmetics and clothes, but also feelings and emotions and relationships. Is witty in the way in which it deliberately sets up something which is outside. Everything else is available, but there are some things that money can't buy, it says, within the context of an ad, which shows us that, in fact, that money seems to be able to buy everything. I was struck by this as well, a recent 20 years of the priceless ads they were celebrating. And here's how one of the executives describes the process.
Priceless is one of those transformational investments that absolutely moved the needle in the company's history. The fact that it has sustained itself for such a long period, but always has been fresh and new, is frankly unbelievable. The fact that it's a globally consistent campaign in places where most companies are still struggling with global consistency, you know, is extraordinary. And now, with the rise of social media, this great marketing team under Raj's leadership is finding whole new ways to make Priceless relevant in a way that's very direct and interacts with the consumers. But I think for me, the things that really are standing out now, and again, it resonates so well with what we're trying to do on financial inclusion and inclusive growth, is the way we're using Priceless, connecting to people's real passions about giving back. If you share a passion for something, to see MasterCard connect Priceless with that and with you, I think it is something you just kind of never forget. And I think Priceless speaks to all those values, and it still catches you. When you experience an ad that's really well done, you see its power in so many different places.
Sorry, let's see. There's a sense of the realm of the giving back, as it were. I love that these ideas of financial inclusion, where the suggestion is that it's a kind of a reaching out so that you can have access. But you can hear in the language of financial inclusion, it's actually a reaching out to enclose you all. Not so much that you can speak through it, but that it speaks through you. Lukács gives us this extraordinary example of he says, with the peculiar frankness of a great thinker, Kant writes this. So he's arguing that in some ways that Kant is putting his finger on something decisive, some formidable change that he sees very clearly, just as we saw Marx arguing in the use of Much Ado About Nothing, Marx arguing that something that Shakespeare saw something very early on, and both of these theorists identify a kind of a perceptiveness or a genius even in the people before them. But this rather extraordinary definition by Kant. Notice what happens here. I'm thinking of there you are at the altar, for instance, talking about the sort of eternity of love and the sort of the giving. And Kant is saying, the view to the mutual possession of each other's sexual attributes for the duration of their lives. It would make quite a good, I suppose, set of wedding vows. You know, I vow to have the reciprocal use of your sexual organs and faculties, and you vow to do the same thing back. But it's a peculiar sense of the sexual organs and faculties are turned into things which can be owned, and you know, owned by one person, owned by another, etc. If we think back to the point that Habermas made in his book on bourgeois publicness, that about the unprecedentedness of romantic love, it seems as though Habermas was talking about the voluntariness of sexual attachment. It was emerging onto the world stage for the first time, he said. But already, it would seem, in Kant's time, it was already being subordinated to this new calculus of, or social logic. So we're not talking about patriarchal authority here, or at least not only, nor about economic necessity, but about the conception of people and their attributes as objects, things to be owned or possessed. Think about the interior stylizing of housing. Let's think about commodity aesthetics generally. I derive the term commodity aesthetics from this tremendous book by Wolfgang Fritz Haug. We'll be reading something from Frieder Haug, his wife, later on in the term. This book came out in the early 1970s. I don't use it in teaching so much anymore because it's very dated in some ways. He's talking about advertising campaigns, for instance, which are engaged in trying to get German men to wear underpants. It seems that they didn't. And the way in which advertising worked by emphasizing it's carrot and stick was the example. So one, you'll get lots of women if you wear underpants, and two, the stick part is you won't smell so badly. So the two things work together. But how is the sense of appearance, sexuality, advertising? He keeps talking about the molding of sensuality. Commodity aesthetics is something that you can work on. It's about styling. Here we have Coca-Cola in St. Mark's Plaza in Rome, or is it Venice? I can't think of where the advertisers have put corn so that it spells Coca-Cola, but the advertisement the photo can't be taken until hundreds or thousands of pigeons have descended to eat the corn, and when they're all there on the ground eating the corn, a helicopter can take a photograph of them so that it spells out Coca-Cola. And what Haug is trying to suggest is that in some sense the system uses us as it gives us what we want, but as in fact it makes us want what it gives us in some sense. Is it a question of it giving us what we want, or is it a way of actually making sure that we want what it gives us? So look at a couple of images here of just these are I suppose opulent interiors. And what Haug is suggesting is that these are, of course, expressions of taste. Here are very much it's difficult to know what term you would use if you think of the densely populated, solidly middle-class interior, which is full of stuff. Working-class interiors define themselves in a certain sense in opposition. Then you have a notion of what you could call sort of yuppie Spartan, for instance, which is not this either. But the way in which opulence is measured here, a certain kind of a consciousness, an eco-consciousness, the window above, etc. Haug is particularly interested in the way in which, in some sense, this expression of taste is also an expression of an internalization of the logic of the commodity. And he then moves across to say, in some sense, what kind of person inhabits that space? What does it feel like? What do you have to be to live comfortably there? I mean, could you ever live comfortably there? Is this a place that you could sink into and say, home at last, in some ways? Who do you have to be that person? This is what, so we move to a sort of living spaces more, again, these are all taken from the sort of Interior Design 2018 books, kitchens. It's both space and efficiency, etc., that's being suggested. Here's Haug writing, this landscape requires its bodies to be placed, and there's an ellipsis here because I've deleted the part which says, and the bodies cannot smell. because that I think is out of date nowadays, but consider how many purchases must be made, how much work done before a body is properly prepared to take its place in this room. It's not only, as it were, that the space is an expression of a working out of a class-based dimension of commodity logic, but the bodies themselves, in other words, the styling of self, including presumably the consciousness. So what do you have to do to turn yourself into those people? You're not born that way. How do you become? It's not only what they're wearing, but I'm talking about also the physiognomy of them, the way in which they sit together even, the notions of conviviality. Everything seems to be registering a commodity logic. Here's a person alone, if you can ever be alone in this context. I mean, aren't you always already, as it were, a walking advertisement or a billboard? So we're talking here the question of bodies which are bodies which are made. These bodies are not easy to acquire. So it's the making of the body in accordance with, obviously, with notions of beauty, but social notions of beauty, but I think more specifically with years of work required to manufacture that body. Who Justin Bieber is already the effect of a commodity logic here. Visibility is more important than ability, you could say. Here, underneath the absurd to me label, natural male care product. So here we have a sort of compulsory heteronormativity. I mean, the woman seems to come as an extra if you're a natural male, as it were. But this idea, you contrast this figure with the Bieber figure, where Bieber is as it were, already worked upon. But here this is taken to be naturalness. And here, recall Marx's comments where the commodity logic turns it upside down. To be a well-favoured, in other words, a handsome man is the great gift of fortune. But really in writing comes by nature. That's how the commodity logic speaks. This is natural. If commodities could talk, as Marx says, what would they say to each other? They would say, this is who we are. These figures speak the language of commodity exchange. Mark Wahlberg, again another sort of worked out body made through years of work there. Let me open a kind of a diversion here to reflect on gender relations or sexual relations. We'll look at this much more next term. But in one sense, I mean, this may give may argue to the contrary. But there's a sense in which, for feminist theorists from about the early 1970s onwards, very often what they focused on was the idea of woman as, this is in John Berger's language, woman as to be looked at-ness. There's a peculiar sense in which one could argue that to be coded socially as female is to know yourself already the object of a masculine society. It's impossible, and the way in which it gets phrased often is the impossibility of not knowing yourself as something which is already seen. Judged, etc., etc. I mean, you could argue, of course, that that's also that logic is extended here to masculine, to men as well. It's very obvious that this figure sees itself being seen, etc. But here's how I'm thinking of these sorts of things. What kind of face is today's woman wearing? That sense of you put on the face, which means if you put on a face, it means that there's a face underneath the face that you put on, isn't there? And that it's that gap, a weird kind of gap that gets spoken about here a lot. Making faces, face forward, etc. This is from an episode of John Berger's great BBC programme, 1972, it's very, very early, so it doesn't necessarily look great. But listen to the points that he's making. It's from Ways of Seeing. There are four parts. All of them can be seen online. There's a little book as well that the BBC published. And it talks about Western art or representations of Western art in some way. So one of the episodes is around the questions of he's talking about the relationship between nakedness and nudity. So the nude obviously is one of the central kind of figures of Western art. And what he said, the important point is to understand that the nude is not naked. That nakedness is when you take your clothes off. The nude is someone who is clothed naked, sees and knows herself being seen, often, of course, drawn by a male painter also. So listen to Berger here. I'll take two brief moments from this.
Men dream of women. A woman in the culture of privileged Europeans is first and foremost a sight to be looked at. What kind of sight is revealed in the average European art painting? There were portraits of women as there were portraits of men, but in one category of painting, women were the principal, ever-recurring subject. That category was the nude. In the nudes of European painting, we can discover some of the criteria and conventions by which women were judged. We can see how women were seen. What then is a nude? In his book on the nude, Kenneth Clark says that being naked is simply being without clothes. The nude, according to him, is a form of art. I would put it differently. To be naked is to be oneself. To be nude is to be seen naked by others and yet not recognized for oneself. A nude has to be seen as an object. In the European oil painting, nakedness is not taken for granted as in archaic art. Nakedness is a sight for those who are dressed. That is why Manet's painting, which really marks the end of the period I'm considering, is so profound a comment on all the works which preceded it.
And let me just go ahead to one moment later on.
Which shapes them. Later, as painting became more secular,
he's talked about biblical art before this.
Offered the opportunity. Painting nudes. But always in the European tradition, the nude implies an awareness of being seen by the spectator. They are not naked as they are. They are naked as you see them. Often, as with the favorite subject of Susanna and the Elders, this is the actual theme of the picture. We join the elders to spy on her. She looks back at us looking at her. Sometimes the woman, Susanna, looks at herself in a mirror, pictured to herself how men see her. She sees herself first and foremost as a sight, which means a sight for men. Thus, the mirror became a symbol of the vanity of women. Yet the male hypocrisy in this is blatant. You paint a naked woman because you enjoy looking at her. You put a mirror in her hand, and you call the painting vanity, thus morally condemning the woman whose nakedness you have depicted for your own pleasure, and thus, incidentally, repeating the biblical example by blaming the woman. The judgment of Paris was another favorite mythological subject with the same inwritten idea of men naked women and judging them. Paris awards the apple to the woman he finds most beautiful. Beauty in this context is bound to become competitive. The judgment of Paris is transformed into the beauty contest. Aesthetics, when applied to women, are not as disinterested as the word beauty might suggest. I don't want to deny the crucial part that seeing plays in sexuality, but there's a great difference between being seen as oneself naked, or seeing another in that way, and a body being put on display. To be naked is to be without disguise. To be on display is to have the surface of one's own skin, the hairs of one's own body, turned into a disguise which cannot be discarded. Amongst the tens of thousands of European oil paintings and nudes, there are perhaps 20, 30 exceptions, paintings in which the artist has seen the woman.
You can see the rest of it yourself. It's a fabulous, this is episode 2. Episode 4 deals exclusively with advertising, which equals publicity at this point. I wanted to just play one more exchange here, which is just from a couple of weeks ago, Mary Beard in conversation with Emma Thompson from Front Row Late, where they seem to be coming back to the same issue. Do it to myself, but okay, let's try again. Try one more time. No, I won't be able to play it for us. Strange that. Copyright. But do have a look at this actually yourselves would be the way to do this. It's from 12:35 until about 14:45, a minute and a half. And what Beard starts by talking about the moment, giving a lecture in her mid-30s, she says, when for the first time she heard her own voice speaking on classics, which is her field, as her own, rather than as a voice given to her as the female classicist, as it were. And Thompson responds by using this extraordinary notion of a gap between your, she says that what does it mean to identify with your identity? And that strange notion of your identity is not necessarily yours. And the sense is that for women, at least that's what they're saying in this point, for women there is a gap between the self that you are and the self that is on display, the self that is presented. So you see, in some senses, it's a depth model, surface and depth, which we see Marx using over and over again. But it's one which seems to talk the language of commodities, although notice that since Berger is talking about early medieval art as well, this language of objectification, of thingification, is not necessarily connected only with capitalism. Certainly, if you're going back to the, if you're talking about masculine objectification of women, you're talking about something that has a much longer history and a much wider history than capitalism itself. The question then becomes, what happens to patriarchal structures, if you like, to established patterns of objectification? Of sex and of sexuality, when it gets absorbed into a capitalist ethos, what happens to those things there? We get to the language of personal branding. There's so many self-help guides to this on the web, isn't it? Marketing an essential tool in branding yourself. The importance, the value of branding yourself is never questioned here. Very obviously these are sites in which you go to for advice on how to brand yourself. So in some sense you're already the object that you're required to be. But I'm struck again at the end of that notion of marketing is a skill that takes persistence to sell yourself as a bona fide professional that is appealing. So what you're selling, you're selling yourself as something which is authentic. But the idea of authenticity here is already abstracted from itself. There's a, you know, in other words, you say this is me, you say, but it isn't you. And even worse, if it is you, because if it is, if you experience yourself really saying this is me, then you have become the object of that object. In some ways, this is the sort of the furthest remove, if you like, of commodity thinking. So that the subject that you once was has become the object of masculine or of commodity society, and you then take up that position as your own. So your subjectivity is defined by the objectivity defined by capitalist society. These are, a number of them are extraordinary sites, I think. So next point, of course, reification is mystification, something that we see with Lukács very often. Reification is the process through which social relations between producers become recognized, represented as social relations between the things that they produce, such that the producers of those objects are themselves then socially constructed as the mere bearers. The word that Marx uses for this is Träger, carriers. It's as though, in some sense, it is your wallet that takes you to the shops, rather than you not forgetting your wallet. You are merely the bearer of exchange value in these contexts. So that what gets spoken about by Lukács is this process in which we become desubjectified or in objectified, that is to say, or we become the objects of the objects that people have made. If we go back to the Marxist formulation, could commodities themselves speak? They would say, our use value may be a thing that interests people. It's no part of us as objects. Objects on the market. So it might be, I mean, we saw last week in both of the seminars that I taught that the question of Marx's notion of use value, people put quite a lot of pressure on that notion, suggesting in fact that perhaps use value is not as stable or durable or basic as Marx imagines it to be. If you set that aside for the moment, the point that is striking here is that for the commodity speaking, use value, meaning in some sense the value that gets consumed in use, whatever that value is, whether it's the clockness of the clock, for instance, or some kind of purely immaterial notion of value or of use. Pleasure, for instance, pleasure is a use value. You buy something to enjoy yourself, and that could be a very mediated notion. But that is not of any interest to the commodities as commodities, to our objects, no part of us as objects. They're speaking in circulation. They only exist as circulation. They don't exist as things that can be used, ever, things that can be consumed, used up, enjoyed, played, whatever term that you want to use there. And of course the commodities then use that strange term, our natural intercourse as commodities proves it. So that commodities, for Marx, have stolen the language of the natural to describe it in a process that is anything but natural, in the sense that it is purely social. It's this process, commodities speaking to each other, is a social process which imagines itself as a natural process. Go back to that image of the natural man standing there. The natural man, is someone who is just himself as he is. These commodities speak in exactly the same way, as though they are natural people. In the eyes of each other, we are nothing but exchange values. So in that process, as commodities speak, it would seem as commodities are speaking, what happens to us? Is what Lukács is concerned with. A suggestion that as commodities speak, we are silenced. That their speech gags us in some ways. That we become silent in their representation. So this is very much another image of a person taken to market by his wallet, so that he is silenced. And I've always been struck by this, the advertisement taken from, is it Roosevelt, the first Roosevelt, who in a quite different context said, in talking about the projection of American power in the early 20th century, said, speak softly and carry a big stick. And I take it meaning what he had in mind was that sense of you don't sort of trumpet out diplomacy or warfare, you just act in that sense. But I think here it's rather something else, that the big stick is obviously the American Express card, the gold American Express card. And the speaking softly, in a sense that human speech, human intercourse, is not required here in any way. This, the production of the card, very often in the advertisements, triumphantly by somebody who is looked at. I mean, and initially he goes in or she goes into some very upscale hotel, for instance, and the concierge looks at her or him kind of faintly, disrespectfully, or challengingly, and they produce the American Express card, which has the effect, of course, of demonstrating not their value, not that they are rich, but that they are worthy. So that the big stick, in other words, that what is won in the eyes of the concierge is respect. You have the money to pay, but it's a kind of respect. You are an index of your value, of your ability to value. So speak softly and carry a big stick. Naomi Klein speaks of the receding horizon, if you like, of use value, in the sense that Marx already said, if you turn a commodity round and round in your hand, you can't find exchange value in it. But when you're looking at exchange value, when commodities are talking to themselves on the market, you can't find use value. But for Marx, every commodity had those two aspects, although they weren't, as it were, if they were the two parts that made up the whole, it wasn't as though the one is the left and the other is the right. Somehow the one is over the other one. When you're talking the language of use value, you're not talking about exchange values. When you say, I've bought this for you because you'll find it useful, you're not saying anything about exchange value. When you're talking the language of exchange value, you are not talking the language of use value at all. So if the two things for Marx are in one composite object, it's hard to see where they are together, because it's as though they both exist in the same thing, the same commodity. The commodity is a mysterious thing, he says. So they're there in the commodity, but it's as though the one is a kind of ghost of the other, or the one makes the other one disappear in some ways. They're both in it, but they're not there. What Klein is suggesting is that in some sense, use value recedes so far that maybe it disappears altogether. Maybe use value has nothing to do with the production of objects anymore. Or maybe what she's talking about is a new kind of use value, in some sense, which is the you buy the shoe not for the using but for the swoosh. Or you buy the shoe for the brand. So in other words, is there a new kind of use value? Or is there, as it were, does the shoe work? Does the shoe have an exchange value? And is the shoe a brand? It's as though there's a third category around here. Use value, exchange value. What is the brand? Is it use? Is it exchange? I mean, of course, as we saw with the with Priceless, it's a brand. It's very, very valuable. Priceless sells. And the swoosh sells, etc., etc. But for Klein, she's saying what's made now is an image rather than a thing. People talk about technology, but Apple is a marketing company. That's a very strong and rather counterintuitive statement. Apple doesn't make computers. They make a lifestyle, in some sense. Got nothing to do with innovative products like the iMac. Oh dear, the typing is bad there. The iMac or the iPad. Maybe the iMac is the new one. But that sense of If it has nothing to do with the iMac or the iPod, what does it have to do with? What does Apple's value on the market consist of? And there's a sense in which Apple's value consists largely in the brand in some ways. So again, when we were speaking of, say, Cristiano Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo's value as a football player is vastly less than the image rights associated with his brand. So that sense is Cristiano Ronaldo a football player? And it's almost as though for Klein, you would want to push that as far as possible and say no, he's a walking brand. I mean, it becomes clear, I suppose, if you're thinking of somebody like who's already retired, say David Beckham. Or something. I was struck by the fact that Adele has just been announced, hasn't she, the wealthiest celebrity. Is that correct in Britain? Her value last year rose £15 million. And they were saying it was rather ironic. I think it's £140 million she commands or something. But it's ironic because she's taken a break from singing or recording for the last year and a bit. So that sense of the Adele's brand, as it were, is more important than her actual singing, in which her use value is embodied. She's a singer, people like her, they buy her records. That's old use value, exchange value. But Adele, as some kind of brand, is another animal, it would seem, altogether. And that's what Klein is particularly interested in us. Mark Globe, author of Emotional Branding, she said, Apple's brand is the key to its survival. If you look at, for instance, this marketing seminar from Starbucks, if you ask yourself, it's easy to see what the where in the old style notion use value in Starbucks would consist. It would consist in the cup of coffee that you buy, execrable, etc., etc. But we all know that has very little to do with Starbucks' value on the market. So here we have here. Again, another spelling mistake: physique, personality, culture, relationship, reflection, self-image, etc. At some place, we have a cozy atmosphere, green colours, proximity, friendship. All of these notions are these to be understood in some sense as the use value of Starbucks, or has that category migrated so much? This is the brand value, presumably. And what is brand value? How do we understand brand value when thinking through use and exchange? I mean, it's obvious you go into Starbucks, you buy the coffee, you drink it. That's use value and exchange value right there. As you drink it, you're consuming the use value of the coffee. That's what it was made for. But it turns out that that's not it at all. It may well be that Starbucks exists to have you as its, you're the bait in some sense. You come in and then Starbucks can sell you to advertisers outside, perhaps some sort of notion. But I'm quite struck by the way in which, again, they tie into these things of giving back, of ecology, environment. Where exactly does the objectification of nature, for instance, end? And it would seem as though it's not. There is no part of ourselves all the way down that is not already at least a site of struggle for a commodity object. We might like to say this is the part of me that I keep outside. This is the me that is me. I mean, you know, however you want to put that. But also in the sense of the world, things that we don't normally think of as being commodity objects. We know, for instance, that land, water, air itself, of course, is increasingly being defined as a commodity with a use value. It does have a use value. It keeps us alive, or if we're to understand the headlines today, it's killing us. And apparently, worse than obesity, so I'm in desperate trouble then, aren't I? Screwed both ways. And a certain kind of pattern of baldness, I've been told, makes me live less long. And left-handed, I mean, basically, you're very lucky that I'm here. So all of these aspects are part of our commodity logic that's being described. I mean, I think that I was thinking of this image of I don't normally like Ai Weiwei's stuff because it seems to me that it rather exploits itself to a significant degree. But this one did make me think the Neolithic vase with Coca-Cola logo. That sense of here we have, I mean, the very idea of a culture which is clearly pre-capitalist, non-capitalist, being incorporated. But in a sense, he didn't need to put the Coca-Cola label onto it. I mean, isn't it the case that just the Neolithic vase standing there in a museum already participates in a commodity universe without even his needing to do that? Of course, that makes the point even more striking. There's a sense in which our objects are survivals from older social formations. Are there aspects of human relationships, marriage, love between two people, love between parents and children? Do those meaningfully exist outside of the circuits of commodity logic? It's obvious that the commodity logic wants them to be inside it, but is there any space left for a kind of resistance? Lukács writing, I mean, it's strange to think that he's writing 100 and something years ago already, 19, well, it's 100 years probably exactly today. He is the person who, for the first time, suggests that in some ways, the commodity logic doesn't stop with the marketing of things. It turns us into things on that market right the way down. So let's stop there. Don't forget to look at the Mary Beard and Emma Thompson. It's an extraordinary moment, I thought. And Thompson is so articulate in expressing this. I don't know what she did at university as an undergraduate. Does anyone know? It was maybe theatre or literature, but she speaks very, very, very sophisticatedly and well on this topic. Thank you. See you tomorrow.